very much. Now my pleasure to introduce our next speaker. Bill Newsom, he's a professor of neurobiology at Stanford University in California, and he's going to speak to us on recent developments in the brain and mind.
So it's a pleasure for me to be here with you today. I certainly enjoyed this meeting. This is my I was with some subset of CIS back last November. I've never been here before. It's a pleasure to meet you and feel participating in the life of the intellectual environment that you have here. I'll be talking today on some recent developments in brain and mind and pursuing the implications of some of the discoveries in the lab for thinking in larger terms about humans and where we are and how we operate and where our minds are like. My students tell me I should always start with big picture, so here's the big picture. We're here on the outer edge of the galaxy, and the other part of the big picture is that everything you know about the galaxy and your world, and every action you make on your world is mediated through this organ here. 3 pounds of wetware that sits inside your cranium that we call the brain. Those of us who are systems neuroscience tend to try to understand the brain and its operations in terms of fundamental operations such as sensation, where we get sensory information about the world that then gives rise to perception at higher levels of the cortex. And perception and sensation are not the same thing. Most of you can see this black triangle here, even though there are no actual boundaries between parts of it. This is the famous Geneva triangle, and perception is an inferential process. At higher levels still, there are decisions that are made about what's in the garden, for example, is present or prey. And depending on what you decide, you will plan one movement or the other and finally execute the movement that acts back on the world. And in this so-called sensory motor loop, we have lots of cognitive processes that systems neuroscience are studying, such as memory, attention, motivation, emotion, and others as well. So the central dogma of neuroscience that all of us working at neuroscience follow in the laboratory that Peter alluded to in a previous talk is that all behavior and mental life, from our perception of the external world to our experience of conscious thought, emerges from and is inextricably linked to the biology of the brain. This is a fairly breathtaking hypothesis, and it wasn't necessarily well accepted until fairly recently, and still, to the average person in the street, seems like a bit of a crazy idea. And of course, the first question is why in the world would neuroscientists believe such a strange thing, and adopt it as their working hypothesis as they go into their lab and do experiments every day? And one reason is that over the last century, we've actually amassed a lot of evidence that this is true. Some of the first evidence came from studies of brain damaged patients, and one of the clearest examples was reported by this man, John Harlow, who's American. He looks British, but he's actually American. For the last century. And I know at least one person in this room, so we have one neurologist here who knows who John Harlow was. Harlow was the first person, any of you who were at Bill Cheshire's talk yesterday afternoon, and this should just be a refresher for you. John Harlow was the first person to suggest a specific behavioral role for orbitofrontal cortex, which is a piece of the cortex that lies on the underside of the front lobe, just in back of the eye orbit, which is why it's called orbitofrontal. And Harlow is famous for 2 papers that he published in the Boston Medical and Surgical Journal. And the first one was entitled 1948, which entitled Passage of the Iron Rod Through the Head. And the second one was 1868, and it was recovered. And this is reported in the famous case of Phineas Gates. Phineas Gates was a railroad worker who was tamping dynamite with a steel pole into some holes in rocks, which was a very bad idea. He struck a spark, and dynamite exploded, and his rod entered his head underneath the cheekbone, made a very nice clean lesion of ventromedial orbitofrontal cortex, and went 100 feet into the air before coming back to Earth. Gage never lost consciousness. His co-workers took him to the hospital. He recovered. He had no permanent deficits in terms of any of his fundamental senses. He could carry on a conversation. He was physically the way he always could. But high, a very high level of integration of personality and planning was totally disrupted. Carl reports his surrounding equations to say he was no longer engaged. Quote, the imagination of his strengths or advice when it conflicts with his desires sounds like all my colleagues at Stanford. At times, his pertinacious was obstinate, yet capricious and baffling, devising many plans for future operations, which are no sooner arranged than they are abandoned in terms of others that appear to be feasible. He was extremely impulsive, being unable to suppress the urges of the moment for the sake of more rational plans to achieve his desires to quickly advance. In other words, this inbred aspect of rational mind and rational planning, the deferral of immediate gratification, were seen to be selectively damaged in this man. There are lots more examples of how the brain and our conscious experience is hyperlinked. This is an example of open brain surgery, which is done routinely in conscious humans. This is a grid of electrodes that's placed on the surface of the brain body surgeons. And this is done frequently to diagnose biblical cases of epilepsy, ultimately for treatment. But the famous Canadian neurologist and neurosurgeon, Wallace Penfield, was the first one to show you that if you actually look at the stimulating brain through these electrodes, rather than simply recording, you can create conscious experiences in the awake human patient that are just as good as real experiences, well, they are real experiences. And what's established is that the electrical activity of the cortex alone to generate conscious experience. So this again points to the tight link between the conscious flux that we live in all the time and the physiological activity of the brain. And then the third one that I would bring to your attention is extremely famous and speaks volumes. Where the experience carried out by Roger Sperry and his colleagues at Caltech in the 1960s, whereby neurosurgeons actually split this structure in the brain. It leads to two hemispheres, this is the corpus callosum. And it carries 100 million nerve fibers that link the right hemisphere of the brain down here to the left hemisphere, which is not shown there. And sometimes, at least through the 60s and 70s, the callosum was severed in the treatment for very severe intractable cases of epilepsy. And the astonishing discovery that was made is that when you sever the corpus callosum, you sever human consciousness, so that each hemisphere has its own locus of consciousness. And using clever tricks, the experimenters can communicate with each hemisphere. Each hemisphere can have a completely independent conscious awareness about what it's doing and how it's interacting with the world, and the two hemispheres are completely unaware of each other. And I can tell you lots more about this later if you want to, but that's just a flavor of some of the profound discoveries that have been made in neuroscience that lead to this working assumption, a single dogma, that our conscious experience and who we are at a very deep level is inextricably linked to functioning of the brain. So I think there are two places where theology and neuroscience, not just theology, but anyone who's interested in the forces of human behavior and who we really are as biological animals, there are at least two intersections that we are all interested in. One being reductionism, the whole issue of reductionism, and the causal status of the mind. And this, of course, was just addressed by Peter Clark in his talk, and I won't have anything more to say about it in my talk. Rather, I'll focus on the second one, which is the nature of consciousness. And who are we really, and how is who we are attached or interacted with or emerged from the brain? And I'll just try to top you up a little bit on the recent results from the laboratory. And one of the things that I think is remarkable about laboratory neuroscience at this point in time is that these things are no longer simply matters of philosophy. For a long time, they're matters of philosophy and wonderment. But in my own lab, we've bumped up now into both of these in the course of our laboratory experiments. And I'll take you through some of these experiments, because I think these philosophical problems become much more concrete and much more germane and much more compelling when you actually see them in the context of what we're doing in the lab. So I'm going to take about 10 minutes here to tell you about some experiments that have been done in my lab. We do a lot of work with the late behavior research monkeys who are trained to do different kinds of behavioral tasks. And when I came into this work in about 1980, 1985, there were two main things said about visual cortex. So I work in visual perception and visually based decision making. And there were two primary things that were known. I mean, two that we knew lots and lots of things, but two really big things. And one thing is that the visual cortex of the monkey brain, and we now know of our own brain, is composed of several different people. The monkeys we now know are over 20. The humans, remember, is approaching 15. And much of the plan that was discovered in monkeys has been shown to exist in humans as well with the advent of the new imaging technology. So this alphabet soup of acronyms here shows some of the areas that are down. The second thing that we knew was that if you put a small, tiny microarray in your brain and snug a tiny little tip up close to a single nerve cell, you can record the electrical action potentials of these nerve cells without being too bothered by the noise from your operating cells. You can actually listen to what nerve cells are saying to each other. And the electrical activity that we measure is the coin of the realm, the currency of information transfer in the nervous system. Like dollars in the US, or pound sterling, euro, or over here, action potentials are in the nervous system. Once I can say information processing in the nervous system, inevitably you're going to be talking at some point about action potentials. And when you start listening to the action potential discharge of single neurons in the visual cortex, you quickly become aware, and those of you who are Mark Shellhammer's talk yesterday, well, this will be a refresher of concepts that he introduced then, you quickly become aware that individual cells in the nervous system, individual cortex, are highly selective. They respond highly selectively to certain important features in the environment. And my favorite kind of cell that I'll talk to you a bit about here, they're directionally selective cells. And these are cells which, if you take a visual stimulus and sweep it across the retina in a particular direction, they will discharge a stream of action potential indicated by these vertical lines here. If you take the same stimulus, we could have the same part of the retina in the opposite direction, you get almost no action potential out of the cell. In other words, the wiring between the retina and the cortex endows these cells in the cortex with this property of direction selectivity. And the notion that arose from this kind of discovery is that these cells probably underlie our ability to measure. And there are lots of other kinds of selective cells in the cortex. There are orientation selective cells, which people believe underlie our ability to see form. There are color selective cells. There are disparity of distance selective cells. And when I came into the field, the fundamental hypothesis, the Lindzen hypothesis about the relationship between physiology, the brain, and the mind, of conceptual psychology, was that the physiological properties of these cells tell you something fundamental about your world of perception. And for 15 years, I wanted to try to empirically test this and determine my satisfaction whether this Lindzen hypothesis was true. I want to take you into the lab right now and actually let you see what one of these direction selective cells look like during an experiment. So our monkeys come into the lab each day, they're trained in corneal tasks. We have these microelectrodes inside the brain. These do not hurt the monkeys. There are thousands of people running around with these electrodes, much bigger electrodes actually inside their brains right now. It's treatment for Parkinson's disease and terminal chronic pain and other neurological diseases as well. And this is chronic pain because the brain has no pain receptors. But it's actually a bad thing in many cases because typically you don't have any warning of brain syndrome until you develop neurological symptoms, and it's actually too late to do anything about it. If you have tenderness in your brain, there would be some pain and inflammation that we respond to earlier, but we don't. But the electrodes don't hurt people, they don't hurt monkeys. So the camera is sitting on the monkey's head. You don't see a monkey. You see the screen that the analysts use. And you're going to see a stream of random dots, first of all, moving in this direction, to this direction, to this direction. And on the soundtrack, you're going to hear a sound that sounds kind of like pop, 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 pop. And every pop you hear is an action potential discharged by the cell. And I'm going to let you just watch the stimulus, listen to the action potential discharged in the cell, and you tell me what you hear from the cell. So there's the clock in this pop, 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 pop. The stimulus came on me that way, and it was a good clock. Pretty good response there. Modest response there. Very poor response there. That wasn't good. But that direction entirely hit the cell. Now as we come back around, picks up again. Now it's the third direction, and the response is like a machine gun. Okay? So you have 10 to 12 neurons in your brain, and all of them are doing that kind of thing all the time. And the world that you're experiencing comes out of that spunk, by some mysterious fashion, comes and emerges out of that kind of activity. And that vision online on microelectrodes. Now, it turns out that this area right here, which is my favorite area, the Little Heckle area, is going to be chock full of these direction selected cells. Over 90% of the cells here are directionally selected. There's a smattering up in an earlier visual area, but this is where most of the system becomes full water. Furthermore, these cells are collected into little patches. So this is looking down on them from the top. Here's your distance scale. This is 1 millimeter. And so the empty is about 10 millimeters long, about 6, 7 millimeters wide, so it's about half the size of my thumbnail. And each of these little red patches is a collection of cells that respond collectively to upward motion. And each of the green patches is a collection of cells, about 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 cells that respond collectively to downward motion. And the dark patches are clustered cells that respond to other directions of motion. So not only are the cells directionally selected, but they're organized into these little patches where their neighbors have the same selectivity that they do. So, this training I want you to do a direction discrimination task. And I'm going to have you do the task now and see if you're as good as monkey bugs. So, you're going to see, and we don't need the sound on this thing, you can just keep the sound all the way down. You're going to see a sequence of these signals. Your job is to yell out the direction of motion that you see. And at the beginning, it's going to be easy because half the dots will be carrying a motion signal up or down. So that's your two choices, up or down. And half the dots are going to be twinkling on and off just to confuse you. They're going to be providing noise. So tell me what direction of motion you see when this signal comes on here. Direction.
Up.
Very good. Okay, you get juice. Direction. Very good. You'd be good monkey. Direction. Okay. Now we're going to go down to 25% of the box and compare motion. 75% of noise. Let's see if you can do this. Tell me the direction you see here.
Down.
Yep. It's down. Very good. Okay. Direction. That's up. Yep. Randy said down. Direction. Exactly. Okay, 25% is pretty easy for you. We're going to go down to 12% now. You can't win again. Direction? I agree. Most of our monkeys can go down to 5 or 6%. Direction? Yep. Okay. Direction? Okay, so now we'll go down to 6%, and then it gets tougher here, but some of you will be able to do this. Some of you probably won't. Direction? Some up, some down, 100 on the left. Direction. I think that was up, but I'm not totally certain. Direction. I don't know. But you get the idea. I mean, this is a technique for measuring sight physical threshold. We can measure perceptual sensitivity in this fashion, and we can convince ourselves that the animals are well trained, that they're working very hard, and the fear thresholds are essentially the same as ours. Now, you might ask yourself, how does the animal tell you what direction of motion is? I mean, ideally, you just call out the answer over the shoulder and you can write it down. But that's not the way it works, okay? What actually happens is this. The animal looks at the TV screen, and he stares at the fixation point. He's sitting in an apparatus that allows us to measure his eye movements very precisely, so we know that he's ready to play. And then he gives a look at the dots, like so. You get to look at the dots like so, all right? And then he's released from fixation, and if he thought the motion was up and to the right, he moves his eyes to this part of it, and if he thought motion was down to the left, he moves his eyes to this part. So he's just sitting there flipping his eyes from target to target to tell us the direction of motion that he sees. And we can do some trials that are hard, some that are easy, some that are impossible, and we only reward him for deciding correctly. But he'll get a shot of juice in his mouth if he decides correctly, and if he decides incorrectly, he does not get a shot of the juice. Now we have Type A and Type B monkeys. Type A monkeys hate it when they think they get a reward. You know, they're really frustrated. But Type B monkeys lie about it. They're the hardest ones to train, actually, Type B monkeys. They're like Type A and Type B teenagers. So when we have the monkeys trained to do this kind of test, we've got an exhaustive set of experiments. We first tried looking drugs into the structure that inactivate cells temporarily. And we showed that it would impair selectively the motion perception on this task. We put microelectrodes in here, recorded from individual cells, and showed that the individual cells were also very, very sensitive to these dot patterns, and sensitive enough, in fact, to account for behavior. But that's a correlative method for studying cells, and we really wanted to establish causality. So the experiment that we did that really nailed this, I think, for the whole field as a whole, is that we put our electrode, this is an up column like this, and while the monkey was looking at the top, and he's trying to figure out if that thing moves up or down, we would electrically stimulate this column with a very tiny current that only activates cells within this patch of up cells right here. Okay? So what we're trying to do is insert an artificial signal into the circuitry and see if the animal actually interprets it as direction of motion or not. And remarkably, he did. So if motion was up and to the right, for example, and you stimulated the polyp and reverted down to the left, you could actually parametrically trade off the artificial stimulation signal in that synaptic system. So stimulation would pull the monkey's position down to the left, but then you could increase the strength of the motion up to the right, you could pull them back up to the right, and you could actually trade them off like that. And the real significance of that experiment is that it took this sort of hypothesis that had been there about the link between the physiological properties of cells and the perceptual capacities of the animal, and it really showed that you could manipulate these circuits at this tiny sort of 50 to 100 micron level and get predictable perceptual decisions out of the organs. And this was most people in my field, the vast majority would not work. And I was actually surprised that it worked, but we tried it. Mostly we wanted that to be consistent, but we tried it, and lo and behold, it worked. So we have published lots of papers on this. We've done a lot of modeling for how you can get from neural activity to the perceptual response. And I can foresee a day, 50 years, 100 years, 200 years down the road, where we might understand this entire effect from in the alpha, where we know all the activity on the retina elicited by the dots, that we can follow the transformations of that activity, the computation through the visual cortex, that we can understand the decision processes, how evidence is accumulated, and how that decision actually informs mind movement at a mechanistic level. But there's still a question that remains. The next question that really bugs me is, what does the monkey see when it enters the stimulus? And I can imagine this, knowing this whole system from input to output and not knowing the answer to this question. And that really, really bugs me. I don't know the answer to this question. If the monkey could talk to me, I don't know what would he say. Would he say, hey guys, I saw upward motion on that trial and I reported upward. Why didn't you give me a reward? Or would he say, you know, I saw upward motion on that trial that I reported downward. I don't know why I did that. Okay? In other words, are we intervening at the level of perception, of real conscious perception here? Or are we intervening at the level of decisions? Are we doing something else that we have no idea what we're doing? The monkey can inform us, the monkey can talk about it. We don't know. I don't know any way to answer that question from third person experiment on the animal. The only way I really know to answer that question is to stimulate my own brain. And maybe you stimulate one of yours, because your brains are not like mine. And I'm on record as saying I want my MCs today. I've actually talked to neurosurgeons about this, and I'm convinced it can be done safely. Epic panels, however, are very unlikely to approve it as much to my wife's relief. But I have issues with this as well, because we pay young men and women to sit on top of Saturn and fly rockets and just shot into orbit. And I can assure you that having your cortex stimulated is much safer than getting on top of the Saturn and fly rockets and just shot into orbit. So I'm not sure what I did. Now, here's the question that arises that elicits a lot of debate among neuroscientists. And is this question here even important from a neuroscientific point of view? A lot of neuroscientists would say, if you understand this little machine from input to output, and you know all the computations that are going to shine the light on it, and you know what the other side is, and the business mechanism turns, then this is irrelevant. It doesn't matter for the one. That is not a neuroscientific problem. Now, I disagree with that. I'm in the minority here in my field. I think this is an important question. And I think if we are happy with our little wiring diagram experience and we don't understand this, then we mine some important stuff out of this mine, like a lot of lead and silver, but we left gold lying in the paper. That's my personal opinion. Now, those of you who are conversant with the current literature in consciousness studies will realize that what we've run up against here in the lab, in real experiments, is what David Chalmers calls the harder problem of consciousness. So Chalmers says that we should think about the easy problem of consciousness and the hard problem. And I like what Steve Pinker said about the easy problem in a recent issue of Time Magazine. The easy problem, calling it an easy problem, sort of like an end joke among science. It's the same thing as calling eradication of cancer an easy problem, or putting an animal on Mars an easy problem. It's easy in that sense for work, in the sense that we have an idea how we might go about doing it. So the easy problem is to distinguish conscious from unconscious mental processes. We all know that there's some things that are susceptible to our conscious inspection, like the status of our bank account, or the sequence of slides in my talk. And there are other things that are going to be completely unconscious and that are not open to conscious inspection, such as how to ride a bicycle. Okay? You can't tell someone how to ride a bicycle. But we can then identify parts of the brain that are involved in conscious processing, and there are strides being made in this right now. And then hopefully that we begin to understand the neural computations that mediate various types of functions, such as decision making, such as sexual discrimination. All of this is an easy problem, not because it's actually easy, but because we have a clue how to go about doing it. We can see a way to get there efficiently. The hard problem of consciousness, on the other hand, is exactly this problem of what does the animal see when the electrically stimulated it sees. The real question is, why should consciousness exist at all? How can those action potentials that we listen to on the audio monitor, which as far as we know is the only thing that neurons are doing up there, how in the world does that give rise to conscious experience? We can all imagine machines that are sophisticated enough and complex enough and built on the same design as the human brain. We can imagine machines that can do most of the things we can do, but still will not be conscious. Why, how is it that electrical activity and matter becomes conscious? Why should there be an internal subjective experience that accompanies electrical activity in the brain? How in the world does this happen? Where does this come from? And I honestly don't have a clue. And Simon Cameron Mars and this morning, Thomas Nagel said that they go to like in the past. And Nagel analyzed this problem very, I think, decisively 20 or 30 years ago in his essay, and he invited us to try to imagine what conscious experience of bat would be like. Bat who navigates by sonar, locates prey by sonar, does not have very excellent vision, for example. And Nagel's bottom line conclusion is that the first person's experience of what it's like to be something is not, in the end, going to be easily reducible by modern third-person scientific terms. Nagel says that the subjective character of experience is fully comprehensible from one point of view, only from one point of view, and that is the first person point of view. You know, what monkey sees that gives it quite a taste, right? I don't know what he sees when I think about it. The mind sees it stimulated if it ever does. You don't even know what I really expect. That any shift to greater objectivity, that is less attached to this specific viewpoint, does not take us nearer to the real nature of the phenomenon. Further away from us. So first-person experience may be a very strange thing here. John Searle takes up the same theme in his book, The Rediscovery of Mind. Searle, in his characteristic combative manner, says much of the bankruptcy of most work in the philosophy of mind, and a great deal of the stability of academic psychology over the past 50 years, you see this as a philosophy of mind. Has come from a persistent failure to recognize the kind of terms of the fact that the ontology of the mental is an irreducible versatile in ontology. So the notion here is that consciousness is intrinsically and perhaps irreducible for a person. I don't like this word. This word has come in bad repute lately. And it's too bad because it's a good word that has been used very inappropriately in today's evolution. But consciousness may be irreducible for a person. But all of modern science, all of what we do in the laboratory is designed to lift us away from the first person and get towards third person experience. Because our modern science, by definition, seeks to describe all of reality in the first person. We want third person descriptions that can be transmitted directly to people around the world, and they can reproduce our observations precisely because it's impersonal and objective of third person. So it may be very, very difficult in the end for modern science to come to this. Our current scientific approach may be fundamentally limited in their ability to understand how consciousness emerges from the brain. Or, as Simon Conway Mars put it more colorfully this morning, the study of consciousness may become the graveyard of ambition for mainstream science. And, you know, I listen to him say things like that, and I say, why can't I say phrases? Why don't I write something boring? He writes something so colorful. That's right. I'm on his finish. Okay. So that is a whirlwind tour, I think, of this particular field as it stands right now. And you should know, I've given you fair warning, that I probably have an audio ticket. Most neuroscientists would probably say there's nothing special about consciousness. It's just one of many brain functions. As neuroscience continues its onward triumphal march, this really is triumphalism. That's going to, you know, we can solve that just like anything else. But I have deep, deep skepticism about that. Now, I want to be clear about one thing, since I'm talking to the audience of Christians here. This is not any kind of doubt and gap argument. Our faith, our Christian faith, does not stand or fall on how well science today is to deal with the phenomenon of consciousness. I'm speaking here strictly as a scientist, strictly as a neuroscientist, and wondering what the future of my field is in dealing with these really difficult problems about who we are as human beings. So we do not stand or fall on this. If science does figure out a way to handle consciousness and understand it, it won't simply, whoever does that will not simply win a Nobel Prize. That discovery will transcend the Nobel Prize. It will be like Newton, it will be like Darwin. Nobel Prize will just be a little pretty model thrown on top of it. That's how big the challenge really is. So I think that taking up one of the things Alex McGrath started last night, you know, he encouraged us to think of our Christian faith, integrating science in our Christian faith, as much more than simply making sense for us. And I agree with that. And I do think we make it, my Christian faith, my Christian point of view, makes sense more. I think it's a coherent view of the physical world and my personal world and my spiritual world. I think it does make sense. But I also think that being a Christian does not in any way detract from the sense of awe that I have of the physical universe. I hope you can tell how much awe I have of the fact that consciousness seems to emerge out of these neural systems. I mean, to me, that's one of the three great miracles that modern consciousness identifies. First is, why is there something rather than nothing? Right? Secondly, what Einstein said, the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it's in fact comprehensible. And third, how does matter become conscious? I'm awestruck. It's beautiful, and it's our Christian view of life builds the community building, it holds us together, not apart. And also the Christian view of life and interpretation of our existence calls for what I believe is our highest ethical response toward humanity and toward God's creation. And this vision was captured by a biologist, some of you may know of, an Australian biologist named Charles Birch, who did a reflection, I'll close with this, a reflection on the book of Job. This is the 38th and 39th chapter, if you will remember, where Job had been, you know, after all of the terrible disasters that happened to him, and he begins lashing out at God and recriminating God. And God has this wonderful speech back to Job, you know, that goes, who is this obscuring my desire through his dictated words? Brace yourself like a fighter. Now it is my turn to ask questions, you inform me. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me since you were so well informed. And God goes on and asks Job fundamentally a bunch of unanswerable questions. Birch reflects, some of these questions are still questions to us, but not all. So, for example, we have more than an inkling now of the extent of the earth and even of the universe. Some physicists have calculated the number of electrons in the universe and come up with around 10 to the 80. What would we do without those physicists to calculate the number of electrons? And what Birch ultimately does is he writes a new version of Job 38:39 and tries to imagine Yahweh addressing us and all of our self-importance aside. And here's the way that Birch paraphrases Job 38:39. Who is this obscuring my designs with its mechanistic models of the universe so that there is really neither for purpose, mind, or consciousness? Brace yourself like a fire, for now it is my turn to ask questions of yours to inform me. Where were you at the Big Bang? How is it that out of the universe of pure hydrogen, you have come into existence? Did life begin when the first cell came into existence, or do elements of life exist in the foundations of the universe? How can you be so sure that all is contrived? How can mind grow from no mind? How can life grow from no life? Do people grow from God's mechanism? Is not a universe which grows human beings as much a human or humanizing universe as a tree which grows apples or an apple tree? Or do you think that things grow in little and great from forth? Does not the life of Jesus tell you something about the life of the universe? Was he not there in some sense from the foundations of it all? You who live in rich countries, can you not see how every increase in your standard of living reduces that of someone in a poor country now, as well as threatening the survival of future generations? Who is madly Christian and not among you to cut his standard of living by a third for the sake of the Lord? Do you think that the world and all that is in it is simply for your use, has no other value? Because there are accidents and chance in the world, why do you think that there is therefore no room for purpose? Can you not have both? And when you have analyzed life beyond just molecular building blocks in DNA, why do you think you have discovered the secret of life when you have not yet discovered the source of love and all feeling? And why do you want to make of me either an all-powerful engineer or an impotent non-entity when I need you? All of which we can only apply to Job's reply. I have been holding forth on matters I cannot understand, on matters beyond me and my knowledge. I knew you then only by hearsay, but now, having seen you with my own eyes, I retract what I have said, and in thus demand you by witness. Thank you.
The only thing I can say is if I can start to understand the trained brain in the laboratory, I'll take that as accomplishment enough for my lifetime. Leave it to some of these bright young people that understand untrained brain.
You can't get punished.
Sorry?
You can't get punished if
you let yourself that. Oh, I am certain. I have done thousands of trials myself. I do lots of this stuff myself, not with simulation, but doing trial runs of the experiment. And even though it becomes a habit, and I can do it very, very well while I'm carrying on a live conversation with someone, I'm still very conscious of those doubts. And I'm very conscious of competing and trying to break my record about how many I get correct at 100 wrong. So I think that there's consciousness. I don't think the culture of repetition rules out conscious experience. You know, in mechanistic science, the goal is the mechanism. is not the phenomenology. You take the phenomenology for granted, and you try to understand why the phenomenology exists in terms of its underlying mechanism. Then, if you can get the underlying mechanism, the phenomenology tends to be taken for granted. I mean, that's characteristic. I mean, cell biologists, I think, take cells for granted. They won't know about signal transduction, they won't know about genes, they won't know about organelles, exocytosis, all this kind of stuff. And the actual function of the cell, the movement of the cell, they take for granted. I think our scientists would take, like, cell biologists, I think, would say, if you understand all those biochemical pathways, then you've understood everything that you're understanding about the cell, and there's nothing more to talk. So some neuroscientists would say, if you understand all this computational processing, you don't need to worry about time. I didn't do that, but a lot of times I do that.